Good morning, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the first of two commercial cargo deliveries to the lunar surface is expected this weekend. NASA scientists say it's a big deal for America's goal of returning to the moon and exploring beyond, but why is that taking so long? It's not like we haven't done this before. Also this morning, the final day of February is Rare Disease Day, but as it turns out, rare diseases are not necessarily as rare as you might think. Findlay High School basketball season is now over. Trojans head coach Ryan Grosch reflects on what was a challenging year. And we have another collection of delicious and easy-to-make recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Friday, February 28th, 2025. Did you see this video the other day? My wife actually showed it to me. I had not seen this. She pointed it out to me yesterday evening. The group of middle school students that thankfully were able to avoid serious injury yesterday morning when they evacuated their burning school bus happened in Cleveland Heights. 15 students were on board the vehicle when it caught fire, and the bus driver is being hailed as a hero for getting everybody off safely. Dramatic photos and video from the scene show a school bus engulfed in flames. It is jaw-dropping. The bus driver said that they relied on their training to help them safely usher the students off the bus and away from danger. No one hurt. If you have not seen this video, it is wow. Jaw-dropping is the only adjective that I can think of at the moment to describe what this video is. If you haven't seen it, it is amazing. Big shout out to all of the school bus drivers. You don't think of that as, you know, like a heroic profession. I mean, certainly a very vital profession, and everybody loves their school bus drivers, but man, that gives you a brand new appreciation for what they do. Amazing video. This is some sad news. Certainly worth pointing out, first thing right out of the gate here this morning, the oldest known Holocaust survivor has passed away. Rose Gironi, or Girone, G-I-R-O-N-E. She passed away in a New York nursing home on Monday at the age of 113. She endured both German and Japanese oppression during World War II, and after the war, moved to the United States, where she worked as a knitting instructor in New York and eventually opened her own store in Queens. And once said that she always tried to find the good, even in tragic events. She said that living through the Holocaust made her unafraid to do anything and everything. Boy, talk about putting a positive spin on a horrific event. Rose Gironi, or Gironi, has passed at the age of 113, oldest known Holocaust survivor. There are actually around 245,000 survivors of the Holocaust known to be still alive today. That is amazing. So, some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Friday morning started, TGIF. A very rare planetary alignment is happening today. Stargazers are able to see seven planets that form a line in the sky just after dusk. Now, not all of them will be easy to see. The hardest ones to see with the naked eye will be Saturn and Neptune. But NASA officials suggest a pair of high-powered binoculars or a telescope will get you the full view. Seven planets, all in a line. The best chance of viewing all seven will be in places free of light pollution and in areas with an unobstructed view of the horizon. Those things always amaze me when, you know, they come up. It's very rare to see something like this celestially, and it always fascinates me, but I never know where to look. I mean, I can't differentiate planets from stars. I'm just not any good at that. But if you are an amateur astronomer, Tonight is your night. It is a big, big deal, I guess. Every day we've got to have a doom and gloom story, right? Life is coming to an end. We're all going to die. Kind of doom and gloom story. Something to worry about. Something to be fearful of. Here is today's, because we can't have a day go by where we don't have a doom and gloom story. We have all heard that sugary treats can cause cavities, and now research from Cornell University has discovered that for some people, starchy foods could influence cavity and gum disease risk. We're talking breads and pasta, any starchy food, specifically those with more AMY1 genes, which are genes that produce enzymes that start breaking down starches in your mouth, which could cause more bacteria to grow and thus influence the development of cavities and a higher risk of gum disease. The takeaway finding, according to the researchers at Cornell, Angela Poole, in charge of this research, says the key finding is that depending on your AMY1 copy number, you may want to be just as vigilant about brushing your teeth after eating those digestible starches. The average person, it says, has between 2 and 20 AMY1 genes. And if you find that starchy foods taste sweet when you begin chewing, that is a possible indicator of having more and being at higher risk. So that is, I mean, because that's the next logical question. Well, how do you know? Well, if starchy foods taste sweet when you begin chewing, that is your clue. So there you go. The doom and gloom story. Something to be worried about today. So you're welcome. Every day we got to have something to be worried about. That's what we're worried about now. Wow. Not just sweets, breads and pasta and things like that could be causing more cavities. And how about this story? I think this is just a really cool story that caught my attention on the newswire. I'm perusing the newswire this morning for the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. And this one jumped out at me. You know, the giant emoji in the Las Vegas Sphere on the Strip in Las Vegas. You've seen the videos of the giant emoji on the outside of the Las Vegas Sphere, right? Well, believe it or not, now, and I don't know why this took so long, but now the giant emoji that lights up the skyline at Sin City has its own name. The character will henceforth be named Orby. Orby has been spotted taunting golfers, sweating under the hot sun. Wore an I voted sticker during the November elections. It is one of the, was it, the Orby has gone viral from the very moment he debuted. The Sphere opened and he debuted. He went viral online with all of these videos. And of course, the Sphere, one of the most amazing concert venues in the world. U2, Fish, the Eagles have all performed there. Orby has become a global phenomenon and a cultural touchstone, according to Chandra Allison, who does publicity for the Sphere in Las Vegas. And of course, the reason why this is significant, Orby now has his own swag. That's right. If you visit their website at shop.thesphere.com, you can get Orby merch. T-shirts and hoodies, even hats and baby wear available featuring Orby, the giant emoji on the Sphere. So he has a name. That's actually pretty cool. I have not been to Vegas since the Sphere opened. The last time we were in Vegas, they were still constructing the Sphere, and it looked amazing, just the construction. So I have not actually seen Orby, the giant emoji, up close and personal, but I've seen the videos. And I guess he's quite the attraction. People are, you know, gathering to see Orby in person. He has a name. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Friday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly to mostly cloudy today. Very windy at times. A high in the low 50s. Cloudy and windy tonight with a low around 30. Major changes are being proposed to Ohio's law regarding adult-use recreational marijuana.
Senate Bill 56 calls for lowering the number of plants allowed to be grown at home from 12 to 6 per household. It only permits the smoking or vaping of marijuana in private homes, no public smoking. The bill would also lower the THC levels from a maximum of 90% to 70%, making marijuana products less potent. And it caps the number of dispensaries in the state at 350. The bill now goes to the House of Representatives.
ONN's Doug Petcash reporting. Finley City Schools held a town hall meeting on the district's finances. The discussion focused on the district's financial challenges following the failed levy in November, which resulted in $6.1 million being slashed from the budget. Superintendent Dr. Andy Hatton says Finley is at a crossroads as a community.
What community do we want to have? What kind of school district do we want to have? And what I believe is this is a proud community with an amazing legacy, and we know what our kids deserve. And we are going to get there. I believe in our kids, and I believe in our staff, and I believe in this community.
The superintendent pointing out that Finley City Schools has not received new operating funds in 20 years while costs continue to rise. And he says if the 1% earned income tax levy passes in May, it would stabilize the district's financial future, ensuring continued support for academic programs, staffing, and student services. Get more on the town hall meeting and more information about the levy that'll be on the ballot in May in this story on our website. A fast-paced afternoon of fun is promised for area residents of all ages on Sunday during the next Fun Day Sunday program at the University of Finley's Mazza Museum. The museum says the program features an Accelerate theme and guests will enjoy activities centered around cars, rockets, airplanes, roller coasters, really anything that goes fast. Get more details in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online at WFIN.com.
Mentioning a little bit earlier that there is something really cool happening in the night sky this evening. It is a rare planetary alignment. Stargazers be able to see seven planets all in a line in the night sky. It'd be just after dusk, apparently. We'll be able to see this. Now, it's some of them, there are a couple of them, Saturn and Neptune, that won't be real easy to see, but you get a good pair of high-powered binoculars or a telescope. It's not like you need a lot of high-dollar scientific equipment to visit this or to see this. It will actually be pretty obvious, I guess, in the night sky. And the best chance of viewing all seven of the planets will be in places that are free of light pollution and in areas with an unobstructed view of the horizon. So if you are so inclined, apparently right after dusk this evening, you'll have the chance to see this very rare planetary alignment. And that is not the only thing that is happening celestially in the universe that is noteworthy this weekend. The first of what will be two deliveries of cargo for NASA to the lunar surface will be touching down this weekend on the surface of the moon, or is expected to happen this weekend in the coming days. This is going to happen, and NASA scientists say this is a really big deal for the goal moving toward America's ultimate goal of returning to the moon and exploring beyond in the universe, maybe going to Mars, and who knows what the future may hold. So they say this is a very big deal. Two of these private missions delivering cargo to the moon. And Dr. Joel Kearns is a NASA Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration and kind of the head of the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program, or leading the way on this. So, Dr. Kearns, first of all, thanks for taking the time. Explain what these missions are and why this is such a big deal.
So America is going to the moon both to answer scientific questions and really to develop a lunar economy, a part of the American economy in the future on the moon. And what's different about the way we've done science in space in the past is that instead of doing it ourselves at NASA, we're contracting with American companies on their missions to take our experiments and equipment to the moon and get us our data back. That not only lets us do it faster and less expensive than if we make our own dedicated mission, but it lets us tap into the all the innovation and entrepreneurship of American companies while they build up a part of the economy on the moon.
Yeah. So what kind of cargo is being delivered with these missions?
Well, we have scientific studies, for example, to learn more about the moon, because, you know, the thinking is that Earth and the moon formed at the same time, really out of one planetary body eons ago. And when you look at the moon in the sky, the moon is like a time machine. If you want to learn what happened at the earliest times that Earth formed and maybe how it influenced life, you can really take a look at the moon. So by studying the moon, we're really studying about Earth. And the other thing is that the moon is the natural first point for us to send astronauts to get further and further out into our solar system, say from the Earth to the moon to Mars. So that's the place you want to develop all your technologies and figure out how to live off the land.
Yeah. Now, I understand that these two lunar landings of this cargo will be at different points of the moon. Why were these locations chosen?
Well, when we sent astronauts to the moon in the 60s and 70s, we landed always in a really narrow place that was close to the equator on the moon. Now we've got the technical capability to go any place, and you will learn different things by going different places on the moon. Like Firefly's lander is going to go to a place in the northeast corner of the moon that we see from Earth called the Sea of Crises to test particular scientific theories and technological equipment. Intuitive Machines landing is going to go all the way to the south pole of the moon, where we think the greatest chances are that there are water ice sitting in these really dark craters that's never been touched. So if we could understand what's going on with water ice, we could see if we could use that in the future to keep astronauts supplied, but also understand, how did water get to the moon and the Earth in the first place? Why are we blessed to have all the water we have on
Earth? It's interesting. You reference the fact that these are different areas of the moon than were explored with previous manned missions to the lunar surface, which actually kind of brings up the question, and I'm sure you've been asked it many times before. Why is this taking so long to go back to the moon? It's not like we don't know how to do this. We've done it before.
Well, you know, we did it in the 60s, but to do it in the 60s, we spent a lot of money on it. I mean, we spent, if I remember right, in the early 60s, a big chunk of the U.S. gross domestic product to beat the Russians to go to the moon.
Yeah.
We're doing it now in a really measured way. You know, we're doing it with the newest technology, with all the things we learned since the 1960s. We're doing it in a way, you know, not to bust the bank, but do it within the constraints we have of money, both in industry and government. In the U.S. And it's really only been since about 2017 that the United States has said, there are so many benefits scientifically and economically to go to the moon. We're trying to get industry to do it. We have certain things the government is going to do, and we got everybody aligned, and now everybody is seeing all the missions that are coming out of it.
You referenced the fact that back during the 60s, it was a race against the Russians to be first to get to the moon. We're not the only country that is exploring the lunar surface today. So is this a new space race?
Well, I would say, you know, nowadays when the United States goes, we not only go with our industry, but we go with other space agencies that are our allies, like Japan, Europe, Canada, you know, places like that. But we also have competitors that want to learn these things and maybe exploit those resources. So there's going to be a lot of partnering, like in the U.S. with industry and with our traditional allies, people that share our values. But there's also going to be a competition to be able to get to those places with other people, which don't share our values, but also want to get the benefits of going there.
And you referenced earlier, and ask you to expand on this a little bit, the implications of this for travel, not just to the moon, but beyond, perhaps to Mars, and then who knows where else in the future. Kind of lay that out for us.
So the moon, because it's pretty far away from Earth, but you can get there within about 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. It's the perfect place to really test the technologies you will need to go to places much further away, like Mars and even destinations beyond that. And you would go to Mars for different reasons, probably, than you'd go to the moon. You know, the science of Mars is really different than the science of the moon. But by learning how to operate far from Earth at the moon and do it reliably and less expensively than we did decades ago, we're getting ourselves ready so we can jump off to Mars and other destinations.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention this. It has some political undertones, and I don't want to get too political on this, but are you confident that the funding to accomplish this, to complete the Artemis mission, will not dry up? I mean, obviously, that's been a big talking point of the past month or so of this new administration, is cost-cutting in government.
Well, you know, we are standing by to hear the new administration's priorities and how Congress will act on those priorities. Mm-hmm. We have our direction that actually came from the Trump administration, the first Trump administration. That's where Artemis came from.
Yeah.
With the focus to go on the moon. So we are keeping our nose down and running and working. For example, we have 5 science missions that have either just launched or getting ready to launch. And we have 2 landings coming up in the next week or so for the moon. So, you know, we'll hear all about that when the administration and the Congress are ready to tell us.
What is the timeline, by the way? I mean, obviously, for most, this is big and very exciting, especially on the science side. But for the average folks, the idea of landing a man on the moon is the exciting thing, ultimately. So what is the timeline look like for that?
Well, in 2026, we're going to send the Artemis 2 mission with a crew of 4 astronauts to circle around the moon, take photographs, check out their spacecraft. And then no earlier than the middle of 2027, we're going to be having the new industry provided from SpaceX, what's called human landing system ready, as well as the new spacesuits. So we will send astronauts in that time to land for the first time at the South Pole of the moon. And we'll follow that up roughly with 1 flight a year minimum to the South Pole of the moon after that. And then in parallel, we'll continue to do these industry-led scientific robotic missions through CLIPS.
Exciting times indeed. Again, with us this morning is Dr. Joel Kearns, NASA Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration, talking about the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program. 2 big landings coming up here soon, the first of which as soon as this weekend. We've got a link on our webpage for more information. You go to goodmornings.net. Dr. Kearns, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
To your health this morning, they are called rare diseases because they typically affect fewer than 200,000 people in the U.S. That's kind of the benchmark for something to be considered rare from a medical standpoint. But collectively, they are not really that rare at all. 1 in 10 Americans, more than half of whom are children, are in fact living with a rare disease, and yet many of those struggles are invisible to the public. So joining us this morning for Rare Disease Day is Chief Executive Officer of the National Organization for Rare Disorders, Pamela Gavin. As we mentioned, Pamela, individually they are rare, collectively they are much more common. Can you kind of put that into some perspective for us here?
Yes, Chris, you are totally right on that one. Collectively, we're looking at more than 30 million people in the United States living with a rare condition. There are about 10,000 rare diseases that we're aware of. So when you look at them collectively, it's not uncommon.
Yeah.
It affects all of us. People living with rare conditions are caregivers, friends, family, neighbors, children, classmates, your colleagues at work. That's why it's so important to raise awareness and remind people that they likely know someone with a rare disease if they don't have one themselves, and can take action to support the community on Rare Disease Day and every day.
So talk a little bit about Rare Disease Day, what it is and why it is important.
Rare Disease Day is a global awareness day. U.S. NORD is the official U.S. sponsor, and we work with other charities around the world representing other countries to raise awareness, to drive an awareness campaign that rare conditions collectively are not rare, and that the struggles that people living with rare conditions face are significant, and that there's something we can do about them. And if we address them, we're also helping people who deal with more common conditions. So that's the point of Rare Disease Day. It's a big awareness campaign that is global. Yeah.
I understand one of the things, one of the initiatives in conjunction with this is something called the Living Rare Study. Talk a little bit about what that is and how it you see it as really a game changer in terms of the future of rare disease care and how the study results could impact even those who don't have a rare disease.
The Living Rare Study is a study that NORD has recently launched that will track experiences of people living with rare conditions and their caregivers over a period of time because their experiences change over time. We don't have a lot of information about how rare diseases affect people's lives, the burden, the physical and mental burden, the financial burden, and therefore we don't have a quantitative data on the solutions that would best apply.
Yeah.
So we've launched this study, and we encourage people to go to NORD's website to participate, because what we will learn will also help us treat people with more common conditions as well.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting you bring that up, and it stands to reason. I mean, one of the challenges with rare diseases is that there's not a whole lot of research being done into treatments and cures, but also similarly, not a lot of research being done into the sort of everyday impact that you're talking about with this Living Rare study. So significant from that aspect. What are some of the most significant barriers that patients with rare diseases face, and talk a little bit about that effort to work toward better solutions?
Well, often people spend many years either being misdiagnosed or not diagnosed at all.
Mm-hmm.
So stumbling through the healthcare system until they have an accurate diagnosis. It can take on average 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
And in that time, it's a very stressful situation, and in that time, their health can worsen, and making it difficult for clinicians to provide the support they, you know, desperately want to provide. So diagnosis is an issue, a lack of treatments that are specific to the condition are an issue. Most clinicians will treat the symptoms because there's only therapies for about 5% of the conditions that we know of that are specific to those diseases. So that's a challenge as well. And then the cost of living with a condition. You had mentioned children being affected. Often 30% of children with rare diseases won't live to their fifth birthday. So they are medically incredibly compromised, very challenging, struggling. And there's a parent that has to stay home to care for them, to keep them comfortable. And that means not only are those costs, medical costs incurred, but they lost a potential income. So there are lots of financial burdens. And then the last burden that is unique to rare disease is that most primary care physicians don't see very many rare diseases in their careers.
Right.
So it's very hard for people to get access to a medical expert. They have to travel far, or they can't travel because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
Or their rare disease expert is across the country, not with even in traveling distance. So really bringing those clinicians together to support one another and to share that expertise is another important part of NORD's work.
Now, we mentioned the Living Rare study. Also, another initiative that you have where everybody can participate is the Show Your Stripes initiative, the hashtag Show Your Stripes, which involves a zebra mascot, which you say underscores some of the things, many of the things that you're talking about in terms of these flaws in the system as a whole that hurt rare disease families. Tell us about this.
So the Show Your Stripes campaign is an awareness campaign, a call to action that allows, like you said, everyone to participate. And it pays homage to the rare disease mascot, the zebra. And that came about because in medical school, every doctor is taught when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras.
Yeah.
Or to consider the more common diagnoses first. But in reality, the zebras are not as uncommon as people think when you look at them collectively.
As it turns out, sometimes it is actually a zebra. Again, Pamela Gavin is the chief executive officer of the National Organization for Rare Disorders. It's Rare Disease Day, talking about the actual true prevalence of this, much more common than you might think. Where do folks get more information and how can we make a difference?
Chris, people can go to NORD's website, rarediseases.org, and from that site, there's lots of opportunities to get engaged and make a difference. They can learn more about the Show Your Stripes campaign. And then lastly, they can make a donation. No donation's too small for us to support people getting access to medical care and treatments, or they can make a donation to research.
Pamela Gavin, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Findlay High School basketball season came to an end this week. The loss to Toledo St. John's in the postseason tournament. That was Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, the Coach's Corner with John Marshall, Trojans head coach Ryan Gross reflected on what was a challenging year for a very young team that hopefully will set the program up for much success in the future.
This was certainly a challenging season for you and your team as you finished with just one win. The thing that impressed me, though, they never stopped working. They never gave up. So now that your first season over, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, you kind of hit it on the head there. You know, we talked about choice a lot in our locker room. It was a choice for those guys to come out and represent their school and community this season, and knowing it was going to be tough, right? I mean, we had huge shoes to fill off of a really good team that graduated everybody, and I praised our kids, like, you know, some people wouldn't have taken that challenge, and you guys did, knowing that it was going to be hard. And then from there, you know, how do we handle hard? You know, so we talk a lot about choice in our locker room. Like, every time we go out on the floor, we have a choice. You know, are we gonna work hard? How are we gonna handle when things don't go our way? And it's not just about basketball; it's about life, right? Your life is gonna be all about choices. And every time that something comes your way, you got to make a choice in how you're gonna handle it. And so, that's really what we tried to live this year. It doesn't show in our record, but you know, there was certainly improvement in our gym with the players that we had.
Keon Flowers was your only senior, didn't play basketball last year. Even so, he came out and gave you some good minutes every game.
Yeah, I really enjoyed getting to know Keon. Played football for the Trojans, and then decided that he was going to, you know, come out, and really looking forward to see, you know, what he does in the future. But he was a joy to be around and be part of our team.
Blade Went has been named the NLL second team, so certainly some nice recognition.
Yeah, you know, a guy that really became reliable for us night in and night out, you know, didn't miss any games. I don't even know if he missed a practice. I know he was battling the flu for a week and showed up every day and fought through it. He didn't look great a couple days, but showed up for us every day, and then became a guy that we could rely on with a little bit of offensive consistency when we were struggling.
You also have juniors Bronson Drew, Beck Garmong, Miles Bailey, who will be back for their senior campaign. They started from almost zero varsity experience and made some real strides this year.
The biggest area of growth for our team, and definitely Beck and Bronson, will just be understanding how to be more consistent with that, right? Like, there's nights where, you know, a few don't go in and you get frustrated, right? And again, that's back to that choice that we talked about. Like, hey, there's going to be nights where they aren't going down. And so how do you manufacture some points anyway, right? You got to, maybe I got to get to the free throw line. Maybe I got to get somebody else open. You know, how can I contribute with handling the basketball and playing defense? So that's just growth overall from a young team that we got to get better at those areas. But those guys, I think, have the skill to continue to improve, but it's just going to be about that consistency.
Same goes for the sophomores. Several of them getting starts this year at one time or another. Riley Korkos, Cooper McKenna, Jed Scott. Then you saw Jaden Thompson, Carter Imke get on the floor. The experience they gained this year will have to make a difference for them next year.
Yeah, I mean, that competition for us will be a good thing, right? We're going to return potentially 30 of our 31 players, right, that were in our program this year, with an incoming class of freshmen that, have had a really successful middle school run. I think losing one game in 2 years in seventh and eighth grade. So that will be huge for our program, and we'll find out, who wants to take the next step.
Part of the conversation with Findlay Trojans head coach Ryan Gross from the Coach's Corner on Wednesday with John Marshall, reflecting on a challenging year this year for a very young team that will be much more experienced and poised for future success. Always best of luck to the Trojans. Your home of Findlay Trojans sports right here, 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A story here that proves the old adage, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. In Florida, Volusia County, Florida, the sheriff's office believes that an 18-year-old young woman intended to spray paint her ex's car, but tagged a neighbor's vehicle instead. She's been accused of vandalizing the wrong car. Police say the woman admitted to being upset at her ex. Police say they saw her driving with two open containers of alcohol, marijuana, and yellow spray paint in the car. She is now facing charges of mischief and underage possession of alcohol, among other things. Meant to spray paint her ex's car and got the wrong vehicle. Oh, my. Elsewhere, just more Florida fun here. Elsewhere in the broken news, this from Iowa, where a woman is in custody after allegedly leading police on a high-speed chase in a stolen car. In a stolen cop car. The woman apparently visited the Keokuk Police Department late Tuesday night to discuss an issue she had with an officer. Police say when she left the police department, she stole a police cruiser from the parking lot and led authorities on a chase up Highway 61. Apparently, she didn't get the answer that she was looking for from the police authorities there. She was eventually caught after returning to the town. Investigators say one officer suffered a cut to his hand. Otherwise, there were no other injuries reported. The woman faces several charges of theft and assault. So, visited the police department and then stole a cop car. Right. Speaking of highway fun here, this in Maine. York, Maine. Where apparently they had a bunch of French fries cooked to a crisp when a tractor trailer hauling curly fries went up in flames on Interstate 95. And whole tractor trailer full of curly fries that were cooked to a crisp. The York Fire Department and Kittery Fire crews responded to over 30 calls of a vehicle on fire on a highway in Maine. Turned out to be Interstate 95. It was quickly determined that the cargo was frozen curly French fries and not any hazardous material, according to the York Fire Department. 6,000 gallons of water are used to soak the fries. Fortunately, no one injured there either. Other than the fries. That's a tragedy. Got a whole truckload of curly fries. That's... hate to waste that. Speaking of stolen vehicles, all kinds of unique stolen vehicles from time to time in the broken news. This one is kind of interesting. This in Washington State, where an $8 million fishing vessel was stolen by a man who allegedly pretended to be the ship's captain. According to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, crew members were on board when they were awakened by a man who hopped on the ship and claimed to be the skipper and then instructed them to set sail. Now, it turns out that the crew was rather new to the job, and they did not know the captain, so they didn't argue. He acted the part. He knew how to start the big boat and knew how to operate it. And so they didn't question it. He must be the owner. He must be the captain. The crew then suspected something was amiss as their self-appointed fearless leader spoke about meeting a Chinese mothership during their voyage. They're going to go visit a Chinese mothership. And they thought, maybe this isn't on the up and up. When the ship returned to port, the suspect was arrested on charges including theft and possession of stolen property. I would think probably kidnapping too, right? I mean, you know, commandeered the ship with the crew. Could be in all kinds of trouble there. We're going to meet the Chinese mothership. I said he just wasn't making sense, so we thought maybe something was amiss there. And finally, in the broken news this morning, a little bit of advice if you are a pet owner. If you have an empty sock drawer and a guilty-looking puppy, probably a good idea to make a trip to the vet ASAP. A 7-month-old Bernese Mountain Dog named Luna had to be treated by the Corona Animal Emergency Center in California after eating a total of 24 socks, among other pieces of clothing. 24 socks, according to a post on the social media account of the veterinarian. Luna's family rushed to get her help after she started vomiting. They went in to remove, you know, the contents of her stomach, and along with the 24 socks, vets recovered a scrunchie, 2 air ties, a onesie, and even a shoe insert. She'd been hungry, apparently. Luna's story. The hospital advises Luna's story is a reminder to trust your instincts. If you notice any unusual or concerning pet behavior, don't wait. Act fast and contact your vet. Prevention is key. 24 socks, a scrunchie, 2 air ties, a onesie, and a shoe insert. I mean, I've had a number of puppies in my day that have been chewers, but that is an extreme. That is an extreme. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. Thank goodness the dog is okay, though. My goodness. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Your home for Cleveland Guardians baseball is WFIN.
Swung on, hit high, hit deep to left. There she goes! A walk-off, 2-run home run by David Fry.
Hear a select schedule of spring training games, all leading up to the season opener on Thursday, March 27th at Kansas City. Your home of the Guardians is 1330 WFIN and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Today is Tooth Fairy Day, and new findings from the Delta Dental 2025 Tooth Fairy Poll have revealed that the average value of a single lost tooth during the past year declined by 14%, from $5.84 to $5.01. From $5.84 to $5.01, marking one of the most significant year-over-year declines in Tooth Fairy giving since the inception of the poll nearly three decades ago. Now, despite the decline in monetary giving since the poll's inception in 1998, the average cash gift left by the Tooth Fairy has increased 285%. Over the lifetime of the poll since 1998. Back in 1998, it was $1.30, and now it's just a hair over $5 per tooth, so a 285% increase. Regionally, the Tooth Fairy is stingiest in the Midwest, averaging a measly $3.46 per tooth, as compared to the South, where he or she doles out $5.71 on average. So, Midwest kids getting gypped here. The record value for lost teeth was reached in 2023, so 2 years ago, an average of $6.23 per single tooth. And kind of interesting, historically, the Tooth Fairy poll has typically mirrored the economy's overall direction. The results of the poll have tracked with the trends of the S&P 500. Now, that was not the case this year. The average tooth value down 14% and the value of the S&P up 26%. But overall, the long-term trend shows growth. As we mentioned, $1.30 in 1998 and $5.01 in 2025. By the way, nearly one in five parents, 19%, say the Tooth Fairy helps teach their child about the value of money. As is traditional, my wife Kyra has joined us in the studio now to finish up the week with another collection of recipes from Kyra's kitchen. And some good stuff.
Yes.
In the the kitchen today. We had this earlier this week?
Like yes.
Monday, Tuesday, something like that? Something like that. Anyway.
One of the days. I think it was Wednesday.
Yeah.
I think I made it on Wednesday.
And this is really a good hearty meal.
Yes, it like was this. Yummy.
We'll start with the green chicken enchilada soup.
Yes, and I really like this. I thought it was good. It wasn't real heavy. It was like...
It was hearty, but not heavy.
Yes, yes. One large boneless, skinless chicken breast, one 28-ounce can of green enchilada sauce, one 24-ounce can of chicken broth, or just measure it, one cup half and half or heavy cream, two cups of shredded mozzarella, Monterey Jack cheese. I ended up just using cheddar cheese. 4 ounce cream cheese softened and 4 ounce green salsa, salt and pepper to taste. So in a 6-quart slow cooker, add chicken breast or thighs, green enchilada sauce, and your chicken broth. Cook on low for 6 to 8 hours. Once that's done, shred your chicken, add your cheese, your cream cheese, your half and half, your green salsa, and let that cook probably for about another hour or so. Mm-hmm. So all that stuff melts and gets yummy. Mm-hmm. Then turn your slow cooker to warm, stir it a couple times, let it just
and you're good to go.
Yeah, completely melt and then enjoy.
Simple as that. Really easy.
Really
good
easy.
Slow cooker. Yes. Easy slow cooker recipe that you can put in.
Really your good crock pot and tasty and yummy.
Have ready in the in the evening. Now, I really enjoyed the crispy cheddar chicken.
Yes.
That you did, and I know there's a lot of chicken because it's the green chicken enchilada soup, and then the crispy cheddar chicken. So if you don't like chicken, this is maybe not for you. But these were really good.
Yes. These were. So 3 large chicken breasts. I actually, with just Chris and I did one large chicken breast.
Yeah, big chicken
breast. 2 sleeves of Ritz crackers, salt and pepper to taste, 1/2 cup of milk, 3 cups of shredded cheddar cheese, 1 teaspoon of dried parsley. Then for your sauce, 2 tablespoons of butter, 2 tablespoons of flour, 2 cups of milk warmed, 2 tablespoons of sour cream, and salt and pepper to taste. So cut each of your chicken breasts into 3 large chunks in a small food processor, which I ended up not getting the food processor out. I just used my rolling pin and
just ground up
the crackers. That way, I like them chunkier anyways. Mm-hmm. So pour the milk into a small pan, add cheese, salt, and pepper to the cracker crumbs, and stir the mixture around to combine.
Not going to need a whole lot of extra salt, I wouldn't think.
No, on that, not
because
really.
Obviously the Ritz crackers are salty.
Yeah.
Judicious with the extra added salt on that.
Yeah. So the milk's going to go in one pan. The cheese, the salt and pepper, and the breadcrumbs are going to go into another one. Dip each piece of chicken into the milk, and then press them into the cracker mixture. Spray a 9x13-inch baking dish with cooking spray, and lay the chicken into the pan. Sprinkle some dried parsley over top of the chicken. Cover the pan with tin foil and bake at 400 degrees for 35 minutes. Remove the foil from the baking dish and then bake for an additional 10 minutes or until the edges of the chicken are golden brown and crispy. I left mine in there maybe a little bit longer than that, just to make sure it was nice and golden and crispy. And then in a medium saucepan, you're going to melt your butter, then add your flour. You're going to be making a roux. Let it cook until golden brown. Slowly add your milk. Let it thicken up. Then add your salt and pepper and your sour cream. Stir and whisk it all together until it's nice and yummy on a medium-high heat. And then make sure it's all nice and thick and serve it over the chicken.
Yeah.
And I sprinkled a little bit more parsley on top.
Yeah, I was going to say, you put a little bit more of a garnish there on the top to dress it up a little bit.
Yep.
It was
really
good.
Yep.
So I really, really like the crispy cheddar chicken.
It was good.
That's a keeper.
It's a keeper. It's going to be a staple probably at our house.
That's a keeper.
It was yummy.
For dessert, this is a really good recipe too.
Yeah.
This is really good. Would be good for Easter, I'm thinking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can do this for your
Easter. That would be a good one for Easter. I think, I think the kids would like this.
Peanut butter and jelly bars.
Yes. So it's 1/2 cup of unsalted butter softened, 3/4 cup of sugar. I didn't have unsalted butter. I just used my regular butter. 1/2 teaspoon of pure vanilla extract, 1 large egg, room temperature, 1 cup creamy peanut butter, 1 1/2 cups of flour, 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder, and 1 cup of grape jelly. So preheat your oven to 350 degrees. Line a 8x8 baking dish with parchment paper. Use an electric mixer. Cream together your butter, your peanut butter, your sugar until light and fluffy. Then add your egg. Beat that in, then add your vanilla, mix that in, and then in a medium mixing bowl, whisk together your flour and your baking powder. Gradually mix the dry ingredients with the wet ingredients, just pouring a little bit of a time of your flour in. Let it mix a little bit, incorporate, then add a little bit more.
Right.
You may have to kind of get at the bottom, especially if you're using a mixer. Spread the jelly. So then evenly spread 2/3 of the dough on the bottom of your baking dish. Spread your jelly on top of that. Crumble the remaining dough on top of the jelly.
You're just crumbling.
Mm-hmm, crumbling it. Mm-hmm. Yep. Just then bake. Preheat your oven to 350 degrees. Bake in your bake for about 30 to 35 minutes. I think I was closer to like around 33 minutes. Make sure it's light and golden brown. Remove from the oven and allow it to cool completely before cutting, or you'll just have a globby, gooey, gobby mess.
Yeah.
Especially with that jelly. You really need to let it cool and then enjoy.
Yeah, really, really good stuff. It is the peanut butter and jelly bars. Interesting, you said you used the salted butter. You didn't have the unsalted. I wonder if it'd be a little bit sweeter if you used the unsalted butter.
Maybe.
Might be. It wasn't.
I don't know. Usually, bad. When you add a little bit of salt, that helps with the sweeten. That brings the sweetness out.
I don't know.
Either way, whichever you like.
The point being, the recipe calls for unsalted butter, but if you don't have unsalted, it doesn't appear to be an issue because they were pretty good anyway. Yes. So the recipes for the green chicken enchilada soup, the crispy cheddar chicken, and the peanut butter and jelly bars are posted on the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page, right? At Kyra's Kitchen WFIN on Facebook, where you can follow along and find all of the recipes from Kyra's Kitchen each week. And also you can share your favorites or share some ways of tweaking Kyra's recipes. We're not offended at all. If you find an interesting twist on those, want to post that.
I think everybody tweaks every recipe.
Absolutely. And also if you have something that you are looking for, you can make a request there on the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page as well. Again, at Kyra's Kitchen WFIN, the link to the Facebook page is posted on our webpage at goodmornings.net. My wife, Kyra, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. Want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Once again, a reminder, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. Coming up Monday on the program, we'll kick off Ohio 4-H week. Plus, new data shows that teaching good financial habits early has a lifelong positive impact. It's an important correlation given the astounding number of young adults who are now entering debt counseling programs. So until Monday morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out, make it a good day, a great weekend. We'll catch you back here next week.